Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It's the Disruption Zone. I am Leland Conway, and I'm excited about this next guest, Lieutenant Dan Crenshaw, Congressman Dan Crenshaw from Texas, back on the show again. He is an American hero. He served in the military, served in wartime, was injured in wartime, and now serves as a congressman from the Houston, Texas area, and he's written a book called Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. It is an unbelievable book, and I highly recommend that you check it out and read it for sure. And of course, he is a philosopher and a thinker, a deep thinker, and I definitely appreciate that about him. And he rose to national prominence when he was made fun of when he was first running for office. He's a former Navy SEAL, and he was running for office, and he has a patch on his eye. And a stupid comedian on Saturday Night Live actually made fun of him for the patch on his eye in a very unwell thought out segment. What was funny was, or what was interesting about it was, that Dan Crenshaw took that not as a victim, but the way that he handled it actually caused Saturday Night Live and their comedians to bring him on Saturday Night Live and apologize to him, and then he yucked it up with them. So he essentially showed us how to get along in a divisive world. So he was literally, he rose to prominence. Pete Davidson was the guy who was making fun of him on Saturday Night Live. He rose to prominence by literally walking his talk. Literally, when he talks about having the fortitude to not be a victim and not be hateful, he literally walked that walk, and it's really powerful stuff. So I want to bring him on here because we're going to talk about Texas, and we're going to talk about America, and we're going to talk about cancel culture and all this kind of stuff. So I want you to definitely tune in and check this out. But first, our podcast is free for you to subscribe to because we have great sponsors who help us make this labor of love come to fruition. And I want to thank my friends at Louisville Cabinets and Countertops for their help with this program. They've done a lot of work for us. And I got to tell you, whenever somebody asks me, hey, I'm remodeling my home, I need a good kitchen guy, I need a good cabinet guy, I need a good countertops guy, I need somebody for the bathroom stuff, I'm always sending them to Tim Montgomery at Louisville Cabinets and Countertops. 6200 Hit Lane in Louisville, Kentucky, right on the border with Oldham County. If you're in southern Indiana, Louisville or Oldham County, I want you to check these guys out. They did work for us, and that's why I send people to them, because I was happy with the work that they did. And I've always respected Tim and his crew's work ethic and respected how he does business. And so I want you to check them out. If you're thinking about doing any kind of remodeling in your home, in your kitchen, whether it's just laying down new countertops or completely redoing the entire thing, or maybe you're doing install yourself and you just want the pieces and parts, they can do that for you as well, and they can help you with all the design process. So check them out. It's 502-930-3304 or LouisvilleCabinetsAndCountertops.com. And now to our conversation with Congressman Dan Crenshaw of Texas. I definitely appreciate you being willing to take a few minutes out of your schedule to chat with us and talk about some things that are going on in the news. First of all, what's going on in your world? What's going on in your life?
Well, you know, we're in full-blown election mode. That's it, right? We're just ground, you know, hitting the pavement. We're getting out there and talking to people, mostly over Zoom, but sometimes in person as well. You know how it is in 2020.
Yeah,
we're having fun. We're excited about this election. It's going to be a tough election nationwide. You know, every place is different, every race is different, but we're pretty happy with where we're at.
What's your assessment of? I guess this feels like a stupid question to ask in an interview with a politician, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because it's kind of like a stupid sports interview question. What do you think is the mood of the people? Like, what are you picking up on is the important issues? Because what I see in the media is two parties at the upper echelon that are essentially mostly existing to oppose each other. What are the kitchen table issues that a guy like you, who's known for having that sort of empathy, that sort of connection with the average voter, what are you picking up on?
Well, I think people are pretty exhausted with the entire year of 2020 and all the things that come with 2020. They're exhausted by the politics of it all. And then people take that exhaustion and they'll blame whichever politician that they disagree with the most. I think that's kind of what we're seeing. And so it's some will make an argument for Donald Trump, some will make an argument against Donald Trump. But exhaustion is the common thread for everybody. It's pretty easy to understand why.
Right.
It's difficult for people to get an objective opinion from the media. Difficult for people to understand what's really going on. There's so much being thrown at them all the time by the media, and a lot of it is spin. So I think that's exhaustion. But fundamentally, what do people care about? Well, we're trying to restore our economy. That's fundamentally what people care about. We want to make sure that we have jobs waiting for us on the other side of this. We want to make sure our businesses can recover. And people care about their health care. I know COVID brought that up in supreme fashion. And what people need to know is that, you know, there's two very divergent paths ahead of us based on this election when it comes to healthcare and the economy. Democrats have a very negative view of business in general. They said they want to raise taxes on businesses. They want to increase regulations on businesses and on labor. They don't think that you should be free to sell your time and labor the way you want to. I'm not just making that up. That's actually in legislation right. that was passed out of the House, and something like the PRO Act, which basically removes independent contracting. You know, and they did this in California, and Uber and Lyft almost had to leave until they got
insane.
A special carve out.
Considered right now. This bill is being considered right now that would essentially end independent contracting?
No, it was already passed. Out of the House.
Oh, and the Senate's going to block it.
This is not conjecture. This is on the Biden-Harris ticket as well on their website.
Meaning if people get the Senate, they're going to want to push this on through.
Right. And this is just one of many things. You look at a $15 minimum wage, right? It feels very compassionate to talk about a $15 minimum wage. I understand that. But the reality is it doesn't change the budget of a small business. A small business just can hire less people or cut right. people's hours. Even Bernie Sanders' campaign did this. Remember?
Yeah,
remember that whole blow up?
Yes. We're going to lay some people off now.
Right. You know, this stuff sounds nice to talk about, but it really hurts our economy and it hurts our recovery. We need now more than ever to remember the principles of economics that bring us out of a depression. And, you know, and in fact, we've done much better than a lot of economists thought we would do. And voters need to understand this, too. Look at the different states and how they're governed. Look at Texas versus California. They have almost double the unemployment rate that we have, and yet their COVID numbers were almost exactly in line with ours.
Right.
So it's very clear which policies work best and which ones don't. And voters need to understand that, I think. It's not just about personalities that we're voting for. I understand a lot of people are turned off by President Trump's personality. I get it. But the policies are what's important. These are the things that really affect your life. And we're talking about removing the tax cuts in the time of a recession. That's a really dangerous thing to say. But that's exactly what's going to happen. Less jobs, less growth. And then on top of that, way more government control over your health care. Right. You know, the Republican stance on health care is we want it to be more personalized. I have bills that do exactly that. I just introduced one last week that would expand great models of primary care for Americans. You know, we want more personalized care with doctors that you actually trust. That's really important for Americans.
I don't want to, not to harp on it, but I want to go back to the bill you said passed about independent contractors. Because I want people that are listening to understand what that means. California passed a bill. The idea behind it was a bunch of liberal garbity goop. And it was like, okay, these contractors are being mistreated. And so we have to protect them by forcing companies that hire them to give them all the benefits. Okay. Completely disregarding that some people literally have made a living with the gig economy. This effectively kills the gig economy in the state of California. So what I want people to understand that when you just say independent contractors, a lot of people are like, I'm not an independent contractor. Well, say goodbye to your gig economy job where you're delivering food or whatever for a fast food delivery service or whatever. If you're not considered a full-on employee, you lose that job. And I just want people to understand it. It's cloaked in this wonderful liberal speak that is, we're trying to protect the workers. But in reality, it's actually destroying your ability to be independent.
Yeah, and you know, they always talk about protecting workers, but what I like to point out is you can't call them workers if they're not working.
Right.
Okay, that's reality.
Right.
Because they're just going to be unemployed after these policies take place.
Right, exactly. Okay, back to the healthcare thing real quick, and then I want to get your reaction on the debate. And I know we don't have a ton of time today, but your healthcare plan, because I've talked about this a lot ad nauseum, going all the way back to like 2008 and 9 when this debate started. So how would you set up the ability to have more competition, more free markets, and more choice in healthcare? Because all I see coming from the left is the one thing they're going to give you is you're going to be guaranteed to be able to go and get some kind of healthcare. But that's it. That's the only guarantee they give you. Whereas it seems as though common sense approach to this would be trying to guarantee you access to care that actually matters. Good care. Care that is driven by competition and people who want to be good at what they do, therefore provide good services. How is your setup?
Yeah, exactly. So when the Democrats talk about free healthcare for everybody, right, that's enticing. Right? Again, it's cloaked in the language of compassion. What they forget to tell people, they deliberately forget to tell people, is that there's trade-offs for that. You're going to start to look like Canada or the UK with way longer wait times, way less quality care, less doctors, and less facilities. I mean, I talked to plenty of independent clinics in the Houston area that would simply close down under a Medicare for All system. They tell me that directly. We would just close down. Because you're really talking about price controls and a very burdensome bureaucracy on top of the healthcare system. People need to know those trade-offs. We have the highest quality healthcare in the world, bar none. It's not even close. So we don't want to sacrifice that. We don't want to sacrifice our innovation either. And we have the best research and development in the world. We're the only ones that are really on the forefront of creating vaccines and treatments for COVID. We have over 300 companies working on that. Second place is China, with like 30 companies, and they're really just stealing ours, let's be honest. So what do we want to do? You have to implement price transparency into the system. You have to allow that choice and competition to flourish, but you also want to help people who can't afford the care. And so a much better system, just speaking in broad terms, is basically premium support. And this is similar to the very popular program Medicare Advantage.
Right.
You know, it's the way, you know, we also assume that people need food, right? And if they can't afford food, we want to help them, you know, via the SNAP program. You don't have some government bureaucracy producing food and distributing food. No, you put the money in the hands of the person so that they can buy the food. And it's similar with healthcare. You got to put the money and the power in the hands of the patient. Let them make that choice. And so, you know, my first step to this would be direct primary care. So I'm focusing on the primary care elements of this. I want people to have a direct relationship with a doctor. Direct primary care means you pay about $75 a month and you have total access to a doctor. Total access. No extra funding, no extra money, no extra fees.
Right.
Now, it's not, but guess what? When you implement this model, premiums go down as a result, right? Because you're already getting this particular care. And you've got a quarterback for your health care and a primary care doctor. This is the first step to fixing the entirety of our broken system. So, you know, we really do have good ideas on this, and it's ideas that protect the foundations of quality for our healthcare system, but also give people the access to healthcare that they need.
Right. Right. Which brings me to something I wanted to talk to you about, which will tie into your book as well, Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. And we'll kind of snake there. But essentially, one of the things is, you're right, there are good ideas on healthcare. There's a couple floating around on the left. Most of the good ones I've heard come on the right, but that's okay. We can sit down and have a conversation. The problem is the fourth estate is cheering on this sort of red side, blue side dichotomy. And again, making it seem as though the two parties exist simply to oppose the other, certainly only focusing on those items that fall in line with that. And we don't hear those ideas. We don't have substantive discussions about healthcare the way you just sort of outline what would be a beautiful way to begin the process of untangling and rebuilding a healthcare system that's designed with the patient in mind. That's compelling stuff. Why, you know, you look at what the media is doing, and I feel like they play a big role in the distortion of what's happening to politics in America. Maybe it's social media that's part of that. But I think the media's complete lack of responsibility in terms of actual journalism. They spent most of this week talking about a fly landing on Pence's head because he absolutely thrashed Harris in the debate. So that's all they had. So they focus on that instead of real news stories.
Yeah, no, that's true. What I want the media to do is just simply properly inform the public.
Right.
You know, instead of creating and fomenting chaos, they should be clarifying the chaos. Because, you know, politics is always going to be about my side's better than your side. That is the nature of politics. That's not going to change. It is the nature of a democracy when people disagree on how they want to solve problems. The role of the media, if they were a responsible entity, would be to simply clarify that chaos and say, hey, okay, Democrats, they want Medicare for all. Don't pretend that there's no trade-offs with that. It would be nice if we had an honest media that said, yeah, that's what they want, but your taxes are going to be doubled and the quality of care is going to plummet and your wait lines are going to extend in an enormous way. So that's all I can really ask of the media, is just to clarify the chaos. And
yeah.
I would.
Yeah, I started out in journalism, and my liberal boss, I was the only conservative in that newsroom. My liberal boss came to me one day and he said, Leland, don't worry about being biased. That's your viewpoint. That's how you were raised. Everybody has bias. What I demand of you is that you be fair. And that always stuck with me, because even the media is going to have bias. What they seem to have become now is activists. And that's a very different thing than, say, leaning to the left or leaning to the right. You know, maybe 10 years ago, maybe Fox leaned a little to the right and CNN leaned a little to the left. But I still remember trusting, you know, guys like Wolf Blitzer and, you know, the whole crew that brought us, you know, the Iraq War. In terms of listening to that coverage, when it was CNN, it was actually 24-hour news. And now, you know, what we get from both the left and right-wing media is exactly what you just described. You know, something that's agging on those two things, as opposed to responsibly informing people about what's actually happening and the ramifications of policy.
Yeah, and it's made people more divided. It's made people bitter and angry. I mean, I talk about the media quite a bit in my book, you know, because the book's about outrage culture.
Right, right.
And you know, the media's role in that is significant. Social media's role in that is very significant, too. I mean, just because of the algorithms used and the way people end up in their specific bubbles of opinion. And then you never see any honest debate, really. And now the lesson I try to give in the book is, a sign of mental fortitude is the ability to sift through that. Fortitude is the ability to stop and say, maybe this isn't quite right. Like, you know, it's like, and again, going back to healthcare, like, is there really this secret utopia where I can just have everything for free without any consequence?
Right.
You know, like, stop and think about that. Of course there's not. There's trade-offs with everything. And responsible governance is about understanding the trade-offs. It's what it means to be a conservative, fundamentally. Like, it is how we solve problems, and we solve problems within a framework of limiting principles, with the understanding that, you know, certain things have to be adhered to: fiscal responsibility, checks and balances, inalienable rights. You know, when you're attempting to solve a problem, are you infringing on the rights of others in order to do that? This is a very fundamental question that the left refuses to answer when they come up with their solutions, but the conservatives are there to say, hey, you can't just come up with the most radical policy and then justify it by saying you care the most.
Right.
Right? Because what you're really doing is implementing careless policies.
You bring up an interesting point, because I think, case in point, you mentioned checks and balances. And the Supreme Court is a big debate right now. The potential confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett. Yesterday, Joe Biden was asked the question, are you going to pack the court? His answer literally contradicted itself. It was a fascinating answer. He said, I'm not going to answer that because... And I'm paraphrasing, but he said, I'm not going to answer that because as soon as I do, it's going to become front page news, and that's all they're going to be worried about. Then he proceeded to continue and say, basically put the blame back on Trump, saying that now the people are not going to get to have an input on how the court is made up because, you know, they're going to confirm this person before an election. And the reason that's doublespeak is because by hiding what his plans are for the Supreme Court, he is, in fact, denying the people who would vote for him or not vote for him based on this issue the ability to determine where they want the direction of the court to go, while he blames Trump of the same thing, even though Trump is within the 4 years of his. You know what? You understand where I'm going with that? Like,
yeah.
That kind of. And
yeah,
I'm like, I'm going, how many people were able to think through that and recognize what he just did there? Because it's a big thing.
You know, it's fascinating to watch them avoid this very simple question. I mean, and then the question should really be framed like this. If you gain the power in the presidency and the Senate and the House, are you going to be so power hungry that you're also going to pack the court because it's just not enough power for you?
Right.
Yes or no?
Right.
And this is a deeply disturbing notion. And the fact that they're not answering it, I think, is an answer in and of itself. Things very clear that you pack the court. Fundamentally transforming our institution so that you can gain more power is extremely dangerous. There's no other way to put this. Kamala Harris's answer to that in the debate with Mike Pence was even sillier, really, because what she talked about, well, okay, let's talk about packing the court. What about all the vacant seats that you filled during your time? It's like, I'm sorry, but this is a pretty false equivalence here. Rightfully and constitutionally filling vacant seats is quite different than deciding that you're going to add more seats just because you don't like the outcome.
Right. Well, and again, thinking that through, you're filling vacancies versus adding new judgeships. That, as far as I know, the president did not add any new judgeships. He just filled vacancies. And to your point, Kamala Harris was fact-checked very strongly by the Washington Post when she made that statement that Abraham Lincoln held off on nominating because he wanted the people to decide. He did want the people to decide, but he was actually waiting for response from the people, not in a vote, but rather direct feedback from people and what they wanted. So it's a very different thing. And the Washington Post actually fact-checked her. Your book, Fortitude, I worry about the next generation being able to really accomplish much of note, not because there is a shortage of young or brilliant minds, Congressman Crenshaw, but because they are going to be saddled with this political correct outrage culture, social media policing of everything they say, do, and think. And I feel like that's part of undermining and destroying meritocracy.
It is. I mean, you know, in many left-wing circles, it's actually a stated goal to undermine meritocracy. They say that meritocracy as a concept itself is corrupt, is potentially racist, misogynistic, whatever words they use. But and of course this is nonsense. And what I point out to people is this is not how you raise your kids.
Right.
You know, so we should speak to the American people like we love them, the way we would speak to our kids. And what you teach your kids is, hey, if you work this hard, this is what you get. Right? There's consequences to your actions. There's rules in life that you must adhere to. There's behavioral rules. There's behavioral standards. You got to work hard. You know, these are the things you teach your kids. And why do you teach your kids that? Because you love them and you want them to succeed. Mm-hmm. And so this message of undermining the basic cultural foundations of Western civilization is very dangerous. And you would only do it if you want to control people, not because you love them, but because you want to control them. Because if there's no meritocracy, well, then it stands to reason that it's because you need somebody else to save you. You need somebody else to help you rise up. This is the message, and it's a really toxic message that they're trying to deliver to our young people, right? And it's a message of control. Right. You don't have any power. You're disempowered, and therefore you need me to help you. This is really dangerous stuff. You know, because we do have probably the brightest generation we've ever had, and I think that'll be true for the next generation. It's got more information and access to more education than ever before in human history. But if you undermine the basic foundations of success, then you're setting up an entire generation for failure.
And I think what's most dangerous about it is then we are left to trust those who are quote-unquote in power, and yet there's no meritocracy. So how are we to know that the power structure in the healthcare system is the best that can be offered? How are we to know that the power structure and the policing and the military and, taking care of the poor and any function of government, if there's no meritocracy, how are we to know that the people in charge of those aspects of our life, because we're turning all of it over to them, are actually the best people to do it? It's a terrifying prospect. I want parents to read your book that are raising kids. What, quick before I let you go, what quick lessons would you offer people up to parents who are raising kids in this generation who will face a wall of resistance from the outrage culture? What are you doing? What are you teaching your kids? What do you propose people teach their kids to help them navigate this?
Well, you know, the book has a variety of lessons. One of those lessons is simply gain perspective, right? And you do difficult things in your life, challenge yourself, and view challenges as a good thing. View your sufferings as a good thing, right? This is taught in the Bible. This is taught in ancient philosophy. You know, we have to tell ourselves the right story about our hardships. And you can tell your story as a victim, or you can tell your story as a victor. And this leads into a deeper conversation about how we view our country. You know, the selection really is about a fundamental cultural question, which is whether America is good or bad. And this is how I wrap up the book. You know, I talk about the stories we tell ourselves and how we get over our hardships. But then I talk about the story of America. And there's this bit ongoing narrative, and it's from, you know, Howard Zinn history. It's from the 1619 Project, that America is fundamentally corrupt and evil. And this is just wrong. This is ahistorical and wrong. Our founding ideals are good, and they come from the best ideas that civilization and human civilization has ever had, from Rome to Athens to Jerusalem to London. We took all the best ideas and we wrote them down. We didn't always live up to them, but we strive to. And the story of America is an inherently good one, and there's those that want to tear it down and tear apart, more importantly, the few things that bring us together, the cultural fabric that brings us together, whether it's our national anthem or our flag or our common history or our culture. Trying to constantly degrade that is very dangerous. You know, there's few things we share as Americans, and we need to uphold those, and we need to be proud of them. So this really is a time of reckoning where we want to teach your kids to love this country.
Yeah.
And it's worth loving. It's the best idea that humankind has ever had.
Do you feel like that it's literally a thirst for power by an elite group of people on the left that are taking advantage of a lot of useful idiots? Because when you read the words of that document, the Declaration of Independence, and you drop all the weird stuff that's sort of surfaced in today's day and age, and you just read those words, viewing each man and woman as equal, and you read those words that the rights supersede the government's ability to take them away, how can anyone be against that? And yet, for generations and hundreds and thousands of years, those that are against that have been successful ultimately. You look at the French Revolution, you look at the Russian Revolution, you look at the rise of Mao, have been successful in commandeering power through the use of the very same tactics we're seeing displayed right now in our society. Is it literally a thirst for power amongst a small group of people on the left?
It is. And as you pointed out, it's consistent throughout history and throughout all countries, right? It's a disposition, you know, and there's two conflicting dispositions here. One is for the people, that this idea that the collective can make decisions for themselves, can self-govern, and that the best government should do to create the most prosperity is to create a structure that prevents people from infringing on each other's rights, right? So this is the more conservative disposition. But the other side of that, as you mentioned, is relevant in the French Revolution and Maoism and communism and Soviet Russia. And it's a very different disposition. It's this idea that elites should rule everybody, and everybody should have to live under the exact same rules as a collective, and that human nature can be fundamentally transformed by these elites into their own kind of utopia. So it's very utopianistic thinking, and it's very dangerous, right? It's very compelling. It's very seductive, especially to young idealists, but it never, ever works because it's fundamentally human nature does not change.
Right.
And, you know, the French Revolution ended in the French Terror, you know, and it's this belief that they can start everything anew, this belief that they can use their reason to tear apart all foundations and all traditions, do away with them because they're old, and create some new kind of utopia. But the problem is it always ends in division, not unity. Okay. It ends in bloodshed, as we've seen throughout history.
Yeah, I've always told people, I'm like, look, if you think that doing away with capitalism is going to lead to a downfall of currency, you're absolutely wrong. It's even more terrifying. Currency right now in a capitalist system is our money, and all of us can go out and make as much of it as we want to, or our talents will bear. But currency in a socialist society is pure political power brought upon by groups destroying the individual himself. That's a terrifying form of currency that no capitalist system has ever even dreamed of in terms of the oppression of people.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. It gets to a question of power. Everything about the way the progressive left thinks about things is in terms of power politics, and that's transformed heavily into identity politics, where it's not about the power of the individual and your own merits, but more about your identity and group on group power. Fundamentally, that's what identity politics is. And again, it's not unifying; it's divisive.
Yeah.
It pits people against each other. And they do this purposefully because it allows them to build a coalition. And that coalition, in their minds, builds up to 51% of the population, and they can tell the 49% what to do.
Yeah.
So it strikes against our basic foundations as a republic, too, which requires checks and balances and states' rights. And again, the ability of people to self-govern. Yeah. You know, this is fundamentally what they're against. And I'm not making this up either. I can just look to their rhetoric. When you want to abolish the Electoral College, add senators by making Washington, D.C. a state, pack the Supreme Court, end the filibuster, you are creating a pure democracy system where 51% of the majority can infringe on the rights of the 49%.
Yeah.
This is a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, no doubt. I have kept you way too long, sir, but you have been very gracious with your time. I encourage people to read your book, Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. We appreciate your time, your patriotism. Thank you for your service, both in Congress and also in the U.S. military and your sacrifice. We appreciate you, sir. Thank you very much.
Hey, great being with you, Lou. Thank you.
All right, you too. Congressman Dan Crenshaw, he's one of my favorites. He is a measured, I love the way he views things. He's a thinker. He's a deep, deep thinker. He's a philosophical thinker. And we just don't have much of that in Congress, and we don't have much of that in society. And so much appreciation to him. And seriously, if you're raising kids right now and you're thinking, you know, you've got brilliant kids. You know, when I say that this generation is going to struggle to accomplish anything of note for human society, it's not because I'm not in any way, shape, or form saying that your kids are stupid. I'm saying that despite the brilliance of this young generation, they're going to be saddled with the prison that is created by outrage, cancel culture. And that is all driven towards the power of the elite on the left-hand side. And if you're trying to figure out how am I going to help my kid be resilient enough to battle through this and still succeed, I highly suggest reading the book Fortitude by Dan Crenshaw, congressman from Texas. So anyway, much appreciation to him for popping on with us. Now, real quickly, I want to thank our sponsors to this program. First and foremost, we really appreciate our friends at Louisville Cabinets and Countertops. And as I've told you many times before, they've done our kitchen and master bathroom, and I swear by their work ethic. They are fantastic. They are, if you're looking for your dream kitchen, I want you to call my friend Tim Montgomery at Louisville Cabinets and Countertops, and they will take you, even if you're sitting here going, you know what, yeah, but I don't know what I want. Just take him your style, take him some pictures of how you decorate the rest of your house. Their designers will help you figure all of that stuff out. They're fantastic. They're over at 6200 Hit Lane, in Louisville, just on the border close to Oldham County. So if you're in the Oldham County area or southern Indiana or Louisville area, they can take good care of you. And again, it's Louisville Cabinets and Countertops. You go to LouisvilleCabinetsandCountertops.com, or if you want to just give them a ring, it's 502-930-3304. Thanks to JP Web Design. Thank you to Dynamics Audio Productions. And thanks to my co-host and co-executive producer, Cameron Mills, who will be on an upcoming episode with his new and beautiful wife. Can't wait to bring that one to you. We're going to be talking about schools and COVID. So that's all coming up right here on the Disruption Zone. You can follow me on Twitter. It's at Leland Show. Instagram is at Great Lelando, and of course the podcast is at Zone Disruption on Twitter and at The Disruption Zone. You can get it for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio's app. Just type in The Disruption Zone, subscribe for free, thanks to our sponsors, for free, and you can have fresh new episodes delivered straight to your phone. Thanks for listening to The Disruption Zone.